When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
That's because I wrote a song when I was a teenager called I'm Voluptuous, Can You Cope With That? And it went, I'm voluptuous, can you cope with that?
Hello and welcome to The Body Protest.
In this podcast, we combine storytelling with science to better understand our relationship with our bodies. I'm Nadia Craddock and I'm a body image researcher.
And I'm Honey Ross and I'm a writer. This podcast is brought to you by The Pink Protest.
3, 2, 1.
Hi, body protesters. I think we like scare each other when we say it. Like we're both like.
Oh my goodness!
It's so funny.
Oh dear! Oh dear!
Hi,
Honey,
Nadia.
How are you doing? Oh, I think it's gonna be one of those days. Honey, how are you doing?
I'm doing okay. I am on a writing deadline at the moment, so going slightly crazy in my little cave of solitude, but very, you know, very happy to be writing is all I can say. How about you?
I am good. I've spent far too long on Zoom today, so I feel a little
disconnected. Zoom fatigue.
Yeah, but in a kind of, because I also feel quite excited, so in a really, like, I just feel very disconnected from everything. Honey, what have we got in store today?
We have got a brilliant episode today. I'm very, very excited. We talk to two brilliant women, one of my best friends, Bibi Cave, and her incredible big sister, Jessie Cave. They are actors, writers, comedians. I mean, they do it all. They are so incredible. We're also joined by Jessie's gorgeous bouncing baby boy 10, who is just an angel, so you'll hear him gurgling lightly throughout the podcast, which is a really lovely addition. We talk a lot about their radical honesty. We talk about acting and body image and how that industry has affected their relationships to themselves and the fat phobia they have faced in the film industry, just because it is a very toxic industry a lot of the time. We also talk about the beauty of the relationship of sisters and how unique it is and their generational gap. They have a 10-year age gap just like me and Nadia, who is a sister in my life, a sister figure.
I know, but I also feel like you're the older sister of the two, the wiser, older soul.
Age is but a number for us. We are.
I know, truly.
And very much with Bibi and Jessie, you see that, like, age is like, you know, in certain contexts, but like it, the connection transcends that, and like their relationship is so beautiful. You can tell they are so obsessed with each other in the nicest way, and it's so, I mean, everybody needs a little slice of sisterly love. It's really special.
Yeah, the conversation really made me think about my relationship with my sister, and I just wanted to be with my sister in the moment. I was like, oh, so sweet.
So here's Bibi and Jessie.
So we thought it'd be quite fun if you two could introduce the other to our audience.
Ooh, I don't know how you feel about doing that. That's fun. That is a bit fun. That's like the games they used to make you play in year seven when you were doing drama GCSE. I mean, you don't do a GCSE in year seven, but you get the idea. And you have to introduce yourself with an adjective that has the same letter as your name. And I introduced myself as Voluptuous Bibi.
Because
I thought that it was spelled with a B. And that's a very inappropriate word to have chosen anyway.
That's because I did a song. This is actually perfect for body protest.
No one.
That's because I wrote a song when I was a teenager called I'm Voluptuous, Can You Cope With That?
Can you cope?
Can you cope? Can you cope with that? I must have been like 14. Oh no, I think I was younger actually. And it was for some reason I decided it would be a country song.
Ooh, wow.
It went, I'm voluptuous, can you cope with that?
I mean, yeah. And that rooted itself deep in my psyche for me to have remembered it 10 years later.
And then go on to call yourself Voluptuous BB.
Voluptuous BB. Welcome to the trap.
So, would love to hear from both of you what your body image was like growing up.
I think I'll go first because I'm older.
Yeah.
And I'm 10.
Age before beauty.
I'm 10 years older, which is huge for so many reasons. But I think I've really warped your body image.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
And I'm really sorry.
No.
But I can't be blamed.
No.
I think.
Heat magazine.
So I'm 33. So I grew up when Britney Spears was coming out, Christina Aguilera was. And I just had such an issue with it. Because I'm not naturally small. I had been a tennis player growing up. So I'd been an athlete and a county swimmer. So I've always been very athletic. So anyway, so I've always been quite broad. And as a girl, I think I found that really, I remember feeling like I was huge compared to the other girls in my year group. And then when I stopped tennis and stopped swimming, and I was left with this quite muscular body, I didn't know what to do with it. I felt, okay, I need to shrink so I can have a tummy like Britney Spears. And I just was the cliche teenager having issues with food, got very thin, then got not very thin, then always felt completely ashamed and went on, you know, diets, starvation diets, binging, you know. I just the classic teenager.
She hit all the kind of greatest hits, you know. My comparison would be that I wasn't as tumultuous a teenager, but and I also wasn't an athlete. We should make that very, very clear.
But you were a dancer.
I do a lot of dance and stuff. I do a lot of dance.
I was like, do you?
I'm
hearing of your dancing career, BB.
I do dance.
No, BB, you did all the dancing shows.
Yeah, I guess you could say I had the strongest jazz hands in Middlesex.
No, probably. You're being self-deprecating here. She is actually being self-deprecating.
I was an amazing dancer. But I think
I've seen you on the floor. I know.
You have. And I think that I didn't really have any issues until I went to a sick form that served all you can eat breakfast, lunch and dinner. And because that was just the first time I'd even like really considered body image, because I was tucking in helping myself. But I didn't realise that the academic pressure at this particular school meant that sort of 50%, I'm not exaggerating, 50% of the girls had eating disorders, anorexia or bulimia at this particular school. And what's stupid is I didn't have one of them, but I felt so inadequate for not, because it was like the fashionable thing. And, you know, it was associated with not even really being about boys so much. It was about your academic prowess. It's like the girls that really took their grades seriously were the ones that also were so strict with themselves and exercised constantly. And I just felt like this sort of slob because I wasn't doing as well at them in school or clearly with the eating disorder. So that kind of, and also, I mean, me and Jessie could talk about it endlessly, but being an actress completely messes up your impression of what you should look like, how you should feel about yourself. And I mean, it's a constant struggle, but at least we can make a joke about it now. So yeah,
kind of. I feel like we're really traumatized.
Truly.
And you talk about your 10-year age gap. I think there is a huge generational divide, especially of the things that we all grew up with as well. I think we're all in recovery from that. Like, I think that fucks with you.
Totally. But also, I'm so glad in a way for your generation, because there is so much more acceptance and positivity, and it just wasn't like that 10 years ago. It was horrible. For instance, starting work as an actress for me when I was 19, and I was very, very thin, but unnaturally so. I got my biggest job ever, and I then when I did the next film, I had gained 2 stone. The costume lady saw me, so she had seen me previously, she knew I was. She came up to me, grabbed my stomach, picked up my fat, and went, what's happened?
Oh my god.
But bear in mind, I had gone from 19 to 21. You know, it was hormonal.
It's your second, like, puberty, they say, right? And I just feel like women are told like you're supposed to have like figured out everything by the time you're 18. But there's such a huge hormonal shift, I think, around that period of time. Totally. That's probably why girls get so upset and so ill probably around that age, because your body's going through stuff that's not really like seen as being an actual shift in the way you're growing, you know?
On top of that, I was playing a teenager, so I felt like, and I've always played younger, so I've always felt like thinner is younger. And I remember another costume, I've been so badly, you know, had awful experience with costume designers, and who've said to me, you know, oh my God, you're a size 10. Well done, you're 21 and you're a size 10. You know, stuff like that. Wow. And it's like, throughout my career, I've had really dodgy experiences with costume ladies. One told me to suck in a scene. She came up to me and she's like, suck in.
Oh my God.
Things that would just be, you know, if people knew this was going on, it's just not acceptable.
No, and it traumatizes you. I feel like you come out of the trauma of your teen years, and then you two go, I mean, and both of you've been working for, you know, acting for a long time, but like you go out into your field and then you're greeted with that after the trauma of already just trying to grow up as a woman. It's rough.
Acting, you know, when you pursue like a dream job or like a creative type of passion, you think or you assume that you're going to get like happiness back from that experience, and you know, people are going to see you as you are and value all the things about you. It can be so destructive for a young person to then experience a job like that and be judged on like the most surface level shit, and to be sort of torn apart, or even just really tiny backhanded compliments or like little things they might say to you at an audition or a fitting or something like that, to realize like this thing that you think is like this wonderful like fusion of soul and passion can be like the most superficial thing ever, and people aren't really judging you for who you are, they're judging you for what you look like, and you just, it gets so warped up in your mind. So like, honestly, all young actors, like, no wonder so many of them really struggle, but also the people that don't, it's like, wow, you must be made of something superhuman or something like that. So yeah, it definitely is not the greatest industry for body confidence.
I'm just thinking, because we know that the negative impacts of appearance-based comments in general, so then when you're being told in the context of your work in a professional setting that you're less than in some way because of your size or because of how you're showing up, it's like, I'm less good at my job because of how I look, and that's the impact that must have, must be huge. And so, yeah, as you say, like, to have that, how people have that iron steel to not let that affect them.
It's so sad that it is associated with how good you are at your job. I remember when I was sort of 18 and I'd gained some weight and I just done like a film or something like that, I gained some weight, and then I found it really difficult to get work for the next couple of years. And I'll never really know if that's because of like the way that my image changed or just because I had bad luck or something like that, but I constantly was plagued by this idea that I wasn't doing the best that I could for my job, despite the fact that it was something I chose so hard at, I worked so hard, I tried to do everything that I could, but because I wasn't like losing weight and whatever, I just constantly felt like I was messing up my job and I wasn't working hard. And that is kind of like, I once even asked my agent at the time, you know, do you think maybe I would get more work if I was like a little bit smaller, I lost some weight or something? And she said, well, people really do like the athletic look, you know, so you could obviously be training, like you could try. And I was just like, oh my God, I'm not an athlete. So I just constantly felt like I wasn't doing my job well. Yeah, it's really difficult.
Do you think having kind of your image taken out into the, you know, taking out of your control in that way, and then going on to do the podcast and to be filming yourself on YouTube, do you think that's actually improved your relationship with yourself?
Totally. Like, we've both transformed, I think, with our body image in the last few years. And I think for me, that was massively impacted by becoming pregnant. I have more love for what bodies can do rather than what they look like. And I think as a result, also, I think BB has seen through my challenges as an actress being bigger. I think we've talked about it so much. And basically, I know for a fact I didn't get work for a few years because I was bigger. I know. And that started me writing and making my own work. And I think BB seeing that from a younger age has been really good for her, because she's realised that,
don't trust them, you know?
don't rely on getting a job, because if you know, you don't look good that day, or you're a bit bigger that day, or you're not being yourself or whatever, Like, it's never going to be there for you. Whereas
you're never going to be good enough for these, like, imaginary people in these executive positions.
You're never going to be thin enough.
Exactly. Nobody is ever going to feel truly, like... I mean, I guess what's so messed up about acting in any kind of, like, creative job like this is because you're getting picked for something. Yeah. It, like, no matter how hard you work at something, you're never really going to have a super strong mentality because you know you're just, like, being plucked. And I think what Jessie's taught me through her kind of, like... relationship with the media and her journey with making her own work, she's kind of taught me that, like, you have so much more power when you just kind of, like, take a step back and you realize, okay, I'm not going to get what I want. Like, there's no special moment where I'm going to get some big break. You have to really, like, just create the work for yourself and be in control, so people can't make you feel shitty about something as unimportant as, like, what you look like.
And I think that's interesting, because I was thinking about, even if it's not the reason that you weren't getting work, like, even if the weight isn't it, you will always go, well, maybe it was. And I think that's the thing of, it comes back to you being like, well, I wasn't good enough and I didn't do hard. And it's like, no, it's nothing to do with that. It's to do with a group of random people making a random decision in a room. And it's so dependent on every factor that happens that day. But the fact is, when you make your own work, you have control, you have autonomy. And also then you get to love yourself and trust yourself again. And that's so healing.
I found it so difficult when... early on in my career, when there would always be one slightly bigger girl in the cast, and I remember always thinking, oh, that would be the role for me and that's not available. Like, for instance, Lena Dunham, you know, she was so brilliant because she just showed her, you know, her full self, like, in pants, naked the entire time, but then everyone else was thin. And I remember thinking, but why can't they all be, like, normal? Why can't they all have bodies there? Why does she get to be herself and everybody else gets to dance around her? And it's the same with most things like that. There's usually one person who's able, the lucky one who's able to be themselves, but everybody else has to conform.
Yeah, but Lena Dunham was the one that created her own work in that, you know, situation. And, like, what was so radical is that she didn't cast herself as some, like, caricature character. She was, like, the romantic lead and the kind of the evil one and, you know, everything like that. Which I just felt, that's why girls were so awesome. You know?
I fully credit Lena Dunham to the fact that giving me the confidence to have a fit boyfriend. I didn't think it was
possible
until I saw her date Adam Driver. I didn't think that would happen for me. And here we are. Jess, you mentioned your gorgeous baby, and of course we can hear lovely 10, and you have 3 kids now. I would be interested to know how you found this experience changed for you doing it later, doing it in your 30s as opposed to doing it in your 20s.
Oh my God, so different. Because my friends are finally starting to have babies, but I got pregnant at 26 with Donnie, which wasn't that young, but now it is really young. In the hospital waiting room for 10, I just could not believe how old all of these women were. Not in a horrible way, but I was just like, what's going on? Why is no one having a baby before they're 40? Why is no one... Everyone was late 30s, 40s, a couple of teenage mums, and then me. I'm so happy it happened to me earlier, because I had Donnie at 27 and Margot at 29, and it's so much harder older. Like, it just is. And that's not because I'm quite fit. I've got a huge amount of support with my...
She drinks so much water. You should see her go.
With my mum, I have so much support with Bibi and my mum and my family. Like, I shouldn't be this hard, but it is still. And it's physically having a baby is exhausting. It's so physically demanding. And I didn't appreciate that before at all. And it's kind of
Jessie's great propaganda for having babies young. Do you know what I mean?
No, but it's so sad because people think that you have to get your career in place and, you know, get this in place, but it just doesn't. It's not like I planned to get pregnant with Donnie. But at the same time, if things had been lined up, I think I would do it all over again, because it's not true that your work life and everything stops when you have a baby. You can do stuff with a baby.
Well, it's another lie that I think women are told, which is that you have to sort of make this choice. You either, like, sort of strive ahead in your career and wait later to have a family, or you kind of sacrifice everything and become this sort of stay-at-home mum. When I just think, Jessie, of course, proves the point that you can excel in your career at the same time as, like, becoming a mother. Because
I wouldn't say excel.
Yeah, but you wouldn't. I'd spell it out in big bubble letters. I mean, obviously we're very, like, supportive, interconnected families, so that's had a big part to play. But I don't know. I just think that it's so sad sometimes that, like, women are, because you're constantly questioning your place in the world anyway, and, like, your legitimacy in work and in everything, it's sad that if people, like, push this moment that they're going to have a family away, further and further away, not everyone, I don't obviously mean everyone wants to have kids and needs to have kids young, but it makes me really sad to think that some people who would have, like, thrived with a baby when they were younger are left in a position maybe when they're older and, you know, it's not as easy for them, or it's not able to happen, you know, because we're told, like, oh, no, you need to get your career in place. Men have babies whenever the fuck they want. You know,
yeah,
whatever.
But I do think there is an element of it depends what industry you're in. So if you're working in the corporate sector, I think there are real pressures in terms of, like, are you going to get maternity leave? And if not, like, what are the repercussions? And I think there's an element where it's a lie, but I also think there's an element where it's truth in terms of how companies, how the country has set up how you're going to be looked after.
Yeah, but it's so gendered. I mean, like...
Yeah, completely, completely.
I like the fact that you don't ever go, it's easy. You're very clear on the fact that it's like, it takes a village, it takes a team, you all do it together. Like, I mean, you wrote a whole play about waking up at 4 a.m. That wasn't obviously the whole play, but that was the premise of the play, of having to get up and fit in time for yourself. And I think it's a very honest comment.
That lasted 4 days.
Yeah, but still. No, but I love that you talk about trying that and being like, can I do this? Like, can I fit in me time in the sunrise hours? I think that's really special. And I think it's really refreshing for women to hear that it's like, it's fulfilling and incredible,
also,
but it's fucking hard.
We kind of got that from our mum, because obviously she had 5 kids and she was still practicing as a doctor until really I was born, number 5. And she says that the reason why we all kind of co-slept together, and I slept in a bed with her for the longest time, was because that was the time of the day that you got to be with the children, even if they were kind of sleeping. It's nice together time. And now she's still wakes up at like 3 a.m. in the morning because she likes the peace and the phones aren't ringing. And even though she hasn't got like young children now running around, it's really nice that she still uses those sunrise hours. So I think it's pretty nice that Jessie does that too.
It didn't, genuinely, though, I lasted like 3 days before I gave up. it's not easy, but if you try and adapt your work goals, then you lower your expectations, then it's okay.
So, Jessie, you said that having babies has changed your relationship with your body. You're thinking more about your body in terms of what it can do as opposed to just what it looks like. I wonder, Phoebe, if you've noticed that change in Jessie, and has that had any influence on how you think and feel?
Oh, definitely. I think I feel like a lot more womanly, warm energy coming from Jessie. I remember when she told me, the day that she was going to tell me that she was pregnant when I was 16 and she was 26, I saw her raise up like the Virgin Mary from the beanbag that was in our living room. And she didn't even have to say the words. I was like, you're pregnant. And she was like, yeah, my God. And ever since then, she just kind of exuded this sort of like serenity and this togetherness. And I think that she's just had so much more of a focus on being strong and being healthy for the children, and less of a kind of, you know,
when I had Donny, my body went through a huge obvious shift with the first child, and also because I had polycystic ovaries before, it was such a shock to me to even be pregnant. And after the baby, it kind of amazingly kind of it cures polycystic ovaries, really, pregnancy, which is brilliant. And my metabolism seems to genuinely just speed up. But it did mean that I was ravenous, like absolutely ravenous the entire time. And we were living in Soho at the time, which sounds very fancy, but we were all living together, like, you know, the Von Trapps. And I would be so hungry, and I kind of got, it does something to your blood sugar breastfeeding. I basically went on a rampage through Soho a few times. I maybe did it about 3 times, where I just went to every single sweet shop, Ben's Cookies, everything. I literally went mad and ate everything you could possibly eat that contained sugar. And I think it only happened maybe once, actually, but I remember in the middle of the night after this kind of madness, I had to get up and feed the baby. And I just couldn't. I was, in the past, if I'd gone on like a sugar rampage, you know, you can just sleep it off. And I remember it was like overnight, I was changed, because I was like, oh, I wasn't able to, you know, to look after my baby properly that yeah. night because I was in a sugar coma. Like, I can't do that again. I'm a mother now. Like, that's not a possible thing. And that was really like a massive shift.
Like, just because you have to, you
yeah.
know,
or give them to my mum so I can do that.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. But this actually just reminded me. I remember when I was 20 and I just met you, honey, actually. This is when we were just starting to become friends. And Jessie and I lived together with Donnie and Marvin. They were very young. And I remember there was definitely like tension between you and I because you had entered this new phase of your life where, you know, you were a mother and you were being very responsible. And I was then living with you and sort of crashing through the house after coming back home drunk from seeing you.
Yeah, I was the bad influence.
And I remember you and I having a discussion where you were just like, you know, you're not looking after yourself. And even though I was probably being really rude to you back, and I was like, fucking, you don't get it. It's just like, just our different sort of positions in the world at that point. It seemed just so jarring to me then, but like I can now look back and be like, oh wow, you know, you were taking responsibility for the children. I was living in a house with the children and I was being super annoying and unhelpful. So I think to answer your question in a very sort of unwinding way, I think that Jessie's shift in her attitude with regards to her body image because of becoming a mother, it took me a couple of years to really adapt to it because I was a bit of a late bloomer and I only started going out like a teenager when I was around 20. So I felt like I was entitled to this like wildness and everything like that.
I stand by the fact you were, but that's because I was maybe yeah. doing it with you.
But then after a few years, I realised like there's so much to be said for kind of like being responsible and just like trying to be more moderate rather than having like a more like immature kind of
attitude. Do you think your proximity to motherhood has impacted that? Like, has, you know, seeing the responsibility Jessie has to live with, has that changed your relationship to yourself and your body?
I drink so much more water than I would have. I mean, it has to be mixed with squash. I do struggle with drinking water by itself, but I think that I just feel a bit like silly or indulgent, which I know is not a word that you should really use, but like now because I'm just like, my mum and Jessie are just so good at being organized because they both have the mother mindset and looking after themselves. I'm a much more messy person naturally, but I still now, I think I've just like learned some really good habits. So I feel very lucky to be in proximity to them.
But now I sound quite rigid. I'm like,
You're not rigid.
Yeah, and I don't focus at all on being thin anymore. Not that that was ever like my number one priority in life, but I don't put any time into things that don't need time.
Exactly. And that's what I meant. Like I really, in part, adopted a more kind of like, useful attitude. Don't invest so much energy in like waiting for a text back from a boy for 4 hours and like, you know, binge drinking and then feeling awful the next day. Like obviously still have some behavior sometimes that's irresponsible and Jessie does too, but because of her motherhood and my mum's motherhood, they've just been able to make me realize sometimes you really do waste time doing certain things when you could be getting more from something else. So I feel very lucky to have them, you know.
Yeah, that's lovely. Yeah,
I love that.
So I want to go back to a conversation that we were having a little bit earlier. So Jessie, I'm closer to you in age. So I'm 35. So I'm really interested in, and all of the people that you were saying before, and weirdly, I always have Nicole Richie in my head in terms of bodies.
I think I have a similar nose to Nicole Richie.
Oh yeah.
Big so time. I at one point. Oh, and you know her big sunglasses.
Yeah.
Why am I wearing the glasses?
It's still there. It's still there.
It's reminding me.
Sorry.
It's
funny just the people that you just have kind of in your mind with that image.
Oh, yeah, please.
But I do think there seems to be a shift in now in terms of the bodies that we see and maybe, and this is a very broad generalisation, and maybe it's because Honey is one of the few Gen Z people that I speak to on a regular basis, but do you feel that there is a shift?
I think, well, in terms of the creative industries or film, TV, whatever, I feel like it looks like it's changed, but actually it still hasn't changed. I mean, most lead actresses are still micro thin, and there's maybe one larger girl in the cast, that's it.
Well, and I think that was so interesting with what you're saying in terms of one person's allowed and then everyone else.
Yeah.
I feel like I'm about to throw something under the bus, which I don't. I think a lot of representation and plus size representation, it's like we get thrown a bone and it is usually like, I was talking about, like, there's a lot of plus-size ginger representation, which actually isn't hitting boxes for me right now, even though you'd think it would. And I think it's interesting because it does feel like I'm always watching a plus-size ginger pining from the side of the screen. And I'm like, why am I not the main character? Because I'm the main character in my life. And so, you know, I hear that. I feel like there's a kind of level of, like, here you go. Here's a pity representation.
We've included it. Now you guys have to shut up about it because we've done our job and now you don't get to say anything about it when it's still like, no, that you're still promoting like an array of unhealthy body images or like, you know, unhealthy messages, like just because you've snuck this one in or like just some sort of sneaky untoward way of like pretending that like the industry is diverse and kind of like understand. I think that the media industry does have a long way to go, but sorry, Jessie, go back to answering.
No, but I think that it has shifted. I mean, like it's probably not appropriate, but when we're, as a family, we put on YouTube and put on like some songs and I don't monitor it very much. So, you know, songs just play on repeat, and so is it Lizzo or Lizzo?
Lizzo
came on and Margot just started dancing. She's four, started dancing madly and now like loves her and stuff like that, like just didn't, there wasn't that around when I was younger, when you were younger, and she's just so brilliant. And like I was just watching her dance the other day, and then the video after Lizzo was Taylor Swift, and it's, and Taylor Swift again, she was dancing madly and loving that. And then I just think that's good because it's showing that she's you know, happy with both, and she's got options. And I think for me, when I was growing up, there was just so few. It was you are either thin or you're useless. And it was so, I felt so rejected by pop culture and everything. So I do think it's definitely better now. And Margot, it will be even, hopefully even better for her. But you need to constantly have discussions like this, which kind of make it clear that it's not normal watching TV and stuff. That's not the normal way. Mm. That's not what everyone looks like. And it's difficult. It's also, I'm probably, as a selfishly, I'm probably looking at things and I'm like for BB sometimes, I'm like, well, it should be hard because it was hard for me. So it should be hard for you.
And I understand that. Do you know what I mean? I truly do understand that.
It's awful, but sometimes I'm like, well, why am I so fucked? You need to be fucked up too.
Exactly. Like, you know, whenever I'm going through a rough patch with my career, Jessie's like, this is, you need to earn the good time.
Yeah. But
I mean, I actually think that leads me beautifully onto the next question, which is, I feel like you two practice radical honesty with each other, and it is very refreshing.
Radical.
And I think you can be
radical. Yes, please. Getting political.
Like you can be very brutal with each other, but then I think on the reverse of that, it's really lovely when you are tender because you know it's real, you know it's honest. Do you think radical honesty is the way to live?
Well, I've had a weird few days. I think it's hormonal because my breastfeeding levels are going all over the place, and
mine too.
Yeah. And I've been so horrible to Alfie, really brutal. It's like I've taken a truth serum or something. And it's just not nice. It's not the right way to live. And I do that a lot with BB.
I can handle it.
Well,
some people can handle, we live in a very radically honest sort of family. And sometimes outsiders might get a snippet and they'll be like, whoa, but you know, we're well seasoned in it.
For instance, so when BB was saying that she doesn't know if she lost out on roles when she gained weight or whatever.
So like when I'm like, you know, feeling sorry for myself, I'm like, oh, I didn't get this job. And I'm like, oh, I think it might be this.
No. I'm really,
she's very brutal with me. She'll be like, yeah, it probably was because of that.
But that's only because I know it was. And I had the same thing. And so I think there's no point faking it and being dishonest sometimes, because if you love someone and you want them to be happy and get the things they want or that, you know, they would like to achieve, and you would help, like, to help them get there, there is no point wasting time by saying things that just don't matter.
Yeah, I think that the radical honesty definitely, it's not for everyone. And it wasn't for me for a little while. I did find it a little difficult for a little while.
I remember those days.
But I truly now get that, like, the people that love you, they have your best interests at heart. And I think that it applies to every kind of form of, like, you know, like, conversation and topic that you can have. but I just feel like the wool has been pulled up over my, like, been pulled off my eyes, not over, because that's the phrase.
The opposite.
It's off my eyes now.
No more wool
on
those eyes.
And I see the world in a very different way. I think that I just don't give as much of a fuck anymore. And I just,
well, I think the elephant in the room is that we've experienced huge tragedy in the last 2 years, and that changes everything. So we are different people now. Yeah. And I think the way we interact is 100% radical honesty, because what's the point?
Is too short.
Life is short, and we want to try and enjoy the rest of it. So we might as well be clear with each other.
Completely.
Because if you really want that person in your life, then why are you with them if you can't even say what you're actually thinking?
Yeah, and I think it's clearly coming from such a place of love. And like, I hear that in terms of you warning BB about things that hurt you in the past. I completely understand that. It's coming from a place of like, I went through this hell and you're going through it too. And I, you know, you lived that. I get it. I hear it.
There's also something so weird about siblings and mother-daughter relationships, because things my mum did in her life, like, I'm following her path, basically. And BB, some of the problems and issues that have arisen so far in your life, I've literally, it's been almost identical a situation. It's just so weird. I find that really crazy.
More and more throughout the pandemic, I've heard my mother's voice coming out of my own mouth. And it's terrifying. It's exciting, but it's scary. But I think we are all destined to become our mothers, and that's fine. You know,
what a blessing.
What a blessing. Goddess women, but it's, you know, it's something to grapple with.
Definitely. Especially, I think, confronting that feeling that you were never, you're not truly special or unique. You know, you are your mother's daughter, and your mother was her mother's daughter. Or even just when you go through something like grief and you kind of realise, oh, wow, life is totally meaningless and horrible stuff happens and nobody's waiting to kind of like come and whisk you away to a magical place where your life is going to be happy. That was very difficult to deal with for everyone in our family at the beginning. But I think that a way it's hugely changed my perspective is that I'm just so much tougher now, and I'm happier in a way, because it's like, I just have the freedom to do stuff because I know it doesn't really mean anything. I know I shouldn't get upset by small things, and you just got to fucking go for it.
Like, for instance, both of us have had rare acting jobs lately.
Congratulations.
And the costume, the same thing happened almost with the, you know, costume experiences. And in the past, it would have just upset me so much. But since, you know, everything has happened, I just couldn't care less now, you know?
It's amazing that you can take grief and transform it into, you know, you can use that grief and pain and channel it into a way of making your life fuller and happier and just, you know, not letting things affect you as much. And I think that's really beautiful.
Thank you. Well, it makes you care so much, even if you're fighting a sibling. There's a bond there that's just so different to other things, even if you don't speak to them for months. It's something that is just unbreakable. And I've always been obsessed with Bibi. Like, she's been in my videos from a young age. Like, all I wanted in life was to have a little sister. I begged my mom. I had three brothers and I begged her. And she's just been this little, you know, thing that I just cherished every year, and I just adore her. And I think that goes when you're both adults and then you're fighting and you're having these, and you're at different points in your lives. But in the last couple of years, it's just become like literally my point in living is to cherish our relationship. And like, if it's like, you know, brutal honesty.
Sure. It's just like when that person is like your everything, there's it's just like being honest with yourself, you know. I realized the other day I was trying to think about like the number of friends I've had. I was trying to think of somebody that I could move in with because I'm trying to move out, and I was like, oh my god, Jessie is the only person that I speak to.
Would you mind telling us a quality you admire in each other?
Okay, cool. That's a great one. I'll go first because Jessie's putting down the baby.
No, I'm fine.
But you go first. Okay. I was just thinking about this the other day when we were doing the podcast together, and I was looking over at her her profile, and she's got these tiny little invisible eyebrows. Jessie doesn't have any eyebrows.
And, that's the quality you admire.
It's the funniest little thing.
That's of all the things you can pick up your sister, you pick
no eyebrows. She has none at all, and it's beautiful. No, I was just looking over at her lovely gleaming face and her no eyebrows and her sweet little eyes, and she was just laughing so sweetly at something. And I think what I just admire so much about Jessie is that she has always, always been weird and unique and done her own thing and but she does it, and she's just been the coolest person always my whole life, as long as I can remember, and I idolized everything that she did, despite the fact that it was so different from what other, you know, girls and stuff were doing. But it's like she's never been aware, like she just, her intentions are so pure. When she's talking to you, it's so real. When she's doing something, it's so genuine. So even if it ends up being like the coolest thing and other people are like, oh my god, your sister's so amazing, it's so funny because I know, like, she has no idea. She's so completely like, what is she like? It's just like, it's just so fascinating to me, because my whole existence is like basing little things I do and the way I dress and the way I sound off of women I admire, very much Jessie being at the top of that list. But it seems like my existence is so curated in a way. And then I look over at Jessie and it's just like the most beautifully authentic thing.
I was going to say something horrible as a joke.
Yeah.
My favorite thing about Phoebe is her, she's much more able to bring in joy to her life than me. And I try and learn from that daily, really, because I'm such a pessimist and such a realist. And I'm so jealous of her ability to do that. She's also quite, you know, you can be darker than me too, but you, it's almost like it's worth it because of your, the joy she can get and the light she brings into people's lives. And she just kind of lights up the room, if that's, you know, that's really cheesy.
I fucking made up a whole nice little unique bit about you.
But you do light up a room. And that's lovely.
I'm joking.
She really does.
You're very special sisters, I have to say.
Thank you so much.
That's so nice. But I completely, in the same way that you feel like you've been formed by me, I would be a completely different person if you hadn't, my whole identity. I dropped out of university so I could hang out with a 10-year-old. Literally, I came back.
Yeah.
I came back every weekend. And then I was like, I think I'm just going to stay, actually. I like her on my sofa.
Exactly. I was pretty cool, to be honest. I remember when we dropped off Jessie at university, you know, for the term that she stayed there.
Six weeks.
I remember dropping Jessie off at the university dorm halls. And I just remember seeing her, you know, sweet, like scared face. And she was sort of quivering as she was saying goodbye to us. And that was the first time like my mum had driven me at night. I'd never been in like a car for a long journey at night. And so we were driving back from this university town. And Moby's song was playing on the radio, you know.
Sad one.
You know that one? I don't know the lyrics.
Feeling so sad.
And anyway, I had the most, like, I actually think that car journey, that song was so sad. I felt so sad. The night was so dark. And we were moving on. I think that was the moment that I became a human being, because I missed Jessie so. I knew that we weren't going to be together anymore. And now I can't listen to any Moby music. Okay, because it just reminds me of that separation thing, you know? Uh-huh. And I don't like driving the car at night either.
That's so beautiful.
We'll find the song. You should link the song in the description.
We will link the song in the show notes. Song in show notes.
Why does my heart feel so sad? That's what it is. Why does my heart feel so sad?
It goes like this. This is all I know.
No.
It's chilling. It's actually chilling to the bone.
I can't stop thinking about your song, I'm Voluptuous. Please, what's the text? Can you sing it one more time?
Can we have a little
just say I'm voluptuous. Can you cope with that? Or do I have to be a stick and stay? Insect. I think I was 12. Okay.
Well, amazing. It's a powerful anthem.
I know. It really is.
It really, really is.
That's amazing. So one thing we like to end on is just asking what you do to look after yourself. So what's your go-to self-care?
Well, I need to get much better at this because I feel so much better if I do. Like, for instance, today I gave my mum for the whole day. So I haven't seen baby all day.
And me.
And baby. And I just locked myself away. And that felt really wrong, but I just feel so much better. And it's not that I didn't want to be with the baby or whatever, but I just felt a lot better. And I've not been good at like that with Donnie and Margot. I was I mean, with Margot, I was, because me and Alfie broke up for a large part of her being a baby and stuff, she was never not on me. So I'm trying to be a bit better this time and have more time.
Setting boundaries with this baby.
Yeah. Also, it sounds so cheesy, but stretching makes me feel so much better. I just can't believe it. And I feel so stupid that I've got to this age and I haven't put time into stretching. I feel so good. It's like, I think it's because I associate stretching with exercise and exercise as work, yes, rather than for something for joy, because I messed up. So I haven't ever given stretching any time.
And actually, it feels amazing. Great. You feel amazing. I'm doing a nighttime stretch. There's nothing like it. It's unbelievable.
Yeah. So that kind of thing, I think. After now, I sound like I've had, you know, a lot of issues with food, but I'm fine. for the first time in years, I had a day recently where I ate everything that was there, and it was just so great because it was just so fun. And I know that you shouldn't endorse binge eating for
really not the place for that, Jessie. I think
no, but you know what, you're not really endorsing not the place you're not endorsing that. You're talking about
it was something I did for joy,
what you want. Yeah, eat what you want.
Exactly. And I actually didn't eat that much, but I just had things that I don't usually have in the house, like, you know, nice biscuits and stuff, and I was like, oh my god,
no, that's lovely.
These biscuits brought me so much joy.
That's lovely.
And it's, yeah, I know it sounds so pathetic.
It's not. And I think there'll be just so many people who will relate to that, or maybe haven't experienced that yet, because people have so much fear or shame around anything that feels pleasurable around food. So
yeah. Well, I've got really obsessed with my mission this year is to become a bodybuilder.
Oh yeah, big time.
I want to get like fucking strong.
Yeah, this is an athlete in her that she suppressed.
Because I've always associated, you know, like I said, I've always run. That's been my main thing. And I've given that up. And I'm now just focusing on getting strong.
Running sucks.
but yeah, I've become obsessed with YouTubers who do their food diaries, like muscle men. So they eat like 8,000 calories a day.
They just fucking build up. They've got those macros.
It's like a mukbang. Like, it's like a boring mukbang. It's like chicken and rice.
Exactly. Oh yeah. So
well, no, I'm sure it's not, actually. That sounds really. I'm sure they have lovely meal prep.
Most of it's quite protein based.
I didn't want to be rude.
But they call it refeed days, and I thought that was really nice, rather than a binge day. So they have days where they just refeed their bodies because they need extra sustenance. I think if you think of it like that, then it's like, oh yeah, I need a refeed day. Yeah, that's nice.
And I think about the word binge, I think sometimes it's so easy to use that word when we're not actually describing a binge. We're just talking about eating without restriction. Like a binge, the definition of a binge is eating objectively a very, very large amount of food and with a loss of control, where you feel like you have absolutely no control over what you're eating and you cannot stop.
Completely. Our language around it is just so messed up. In the episode that me and Jessie are releasing of our podcast tomorrow, Thursday, we talk a lot about these YouTube videos, the sort of what I eat in a day videos, binging videos, all this kind of like really weirdly addictive, like watching material that's clearly got something so toxic behind it. But why is there such a huge appetite for it in terms of like people that watch these videos? Because there are so many of them with so many millions of views. And we just kind of just discuss the way that those kind of videos have impacted us and like the attitudes that a lot of girls have in terms of like binging, because you're so right, I've literally never thought of it that way. When you label something as a binge, it's normally just you not like actively, you know,
restricting.
Should I answer what I do to take care of myself?
Yes, please.
Okay, I've started dancing in the evenings.
Lovely.
I know that sounds very silly.
No, it's gorgeous. We love a dance here.
It's, oh god, I now sound like one of those, like, you know, oh, I dance, like, I don't mean it like that, like, I just I used to dance a lot when I was younger, and then I just haven't really for the last couple of years. I don't know, I think it's because I got really into watching TikTok videos and seeing all of these amazing dancers, and at first I found them annoying because it tended to be like just really beautiful teenagers like doing really sexy dances, and I was like, I'm not here for that. But when I started seeing like
fully grown adults and boys and children and everyone. It could be anyone doing really, really cool dances just in their living room. I don't know. It just like inspired me to just you know, pick up the old dancing bones and do it again. So I've been trying to learn some TikTok dances.
I love it. And you have a favorite?
Yeah. I mean, I'd show you guys, but then the listeners aren't gonna get to enjoy it. They'll just hear me stomping about. Maybe I'll show you after. But it's, I don't know, like that is just doing something silly that's just for a bit of fun. That's really, I really enjoyed that so much more than I expected. Just dancing around a bit every day. Having a great time.
It's the biggest release. No, solo dancing, putting on something you love and just moving in your space and not doing it, not trying to look good even, just doing what you've got to do, is there's nothing more liberating. And it's so healing.
It's just because I can't wait to go out dancing again. It's going to be so wonderful.
Well, especially with all the TikTok dances, everyone's going to be doing the same routine.
All over again.
Exactly.
I'm so excited. All the hoedown throwdown. Wow. How can we and our audience support you in your work?
So we have a podcast called We Can't Talk About That Right Now.
Sorry, he's gonna...
Is he okay?
Yeah. It's all right.
He wants to promote himself. It's like, give us our chance.
He's got a podcast too.
Then he's got... It's called Baby Talk, obviously. Anyway, our podcast is called We Can't Talk About That Right Now. You can find her on... Spotify. Wouldn't it be funny if I said him? Like, oh, our podcast is a man.
That's a curveball.
You can find her on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and on YouTube. And we film it, and it's a bit of fun. We have a different backdrop every week that our mom has made for us, and it's fun. You can see our outfits, how tired we look. It's great.
And you could pre-order my novel, which is about sisters, inspired by Bibi, called Sunset.
It's beautiful.
It's out in June.
Go for it, guys. And you can support me by just sending out good vibes into the universe and just saying, I can't wait to see Bibi Cave in London, vibing and dancing and just living her life. That's what you can do for me.
You're also looking for a roommate.
Looking for a roommate. So if anybody wants,
please get in touch.
Okay, Jessie's gonna go.
Bye, Jessie. Thank you so much.
Bye, bye.
Bye, Tim.
Bye. So there we go. BK closes the show alone, and that's fine.
What an absolute joy to talk to the Cave Sisters. God, they're just such unique and delightful women. But something that came up quite a lot in the episode during the conversation was the term binge. We see that word thrown around quite a lot these days, but what actually is the difference between binge eating and binge eating disorder?
Very good question. And as you said, we do hear the term binge eating a lot, or having a binge on something. So really good to lay out some definitions. So I'm going to give the official definition from the DSM-5, so the fifth edition of the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual for Mental Disorders, which psychologists, psychiatrists, and other health professionals use as a guide for all mental health conditions. So how people classify a pattern of eating as binge eating, they're looking for two things. So one is eating an amount of food that's definitely larger than most people would eat in a similar period of time under similar circumstances. And then the second, so you need the two things to come along together, is an experience of feeling a loss of control whilst you're eating. So like you can't stop eating, or you have no choice over what you're eating.
The loss of control is a key characteristic, but what else should we look for?
Really good question. So binge eating is also associated with eating a lot quicker than usual, eating past that point of comfortable fullness. People who are binge eating often eat in secret and then feel very ashamed and guilty and disgusted about that pattern of eating. A binge can be very distressing for people. And then what we see as a response to that distress often is that people try and either punish themselves or compensate for the binge with restriction or dieting, which is seen as, quote, good to try and offset the binge. But that's where we see the classic binge restrict cycle coming in, so it's kind of self-perpetuating in that way.
Okay, so binge eating is not eating fun foods and overindulging, in air quotes.
Yeah, exactly. Binge eating is neither of those things. And I think what's really key is that it's really distressing and it can have a huge impact on someone's self-esteem, confidence, mood, and physical health.
Right, so that's binge eating. Can you tell me what binge eating disorder is?
Yes, I can. And this is again going back to the DSM-5, so using the criteria that they use. So binge eating disorder is characterized by repeated episodes of binge eating. So just as we've described what binge eating is, it's like it's this repeated pattern, which again is associated with feelings of distress and shame. And to differentiate it from other eating disorders like bulimia nervosa, with binge eating disorder, there's binging but no compensatory behaviours in the sense of vomiting or laxative abuse that we see with bulimia. So that's how we kind of separate the two. And then in the current DSM, so the fifth edition, the diagnostic criteria on the frequency and duration specifies that the binge eating periods, it's at least one day a week for a period of 3 months for that full threshold binge eating disorder label. So they kind of give a criteria on it for that frequency and duration. And so when people don't meet that criteria, so they engage in binge eating, but it's less frequent than that or for a shorter period perhaps, they may still meet a criteria for an eating disorder, but this can fall under the umbrella of off-fed, which is the other specified feeding and eating disorders, which is a bit of a catch-all, but still what's really important to say that's still really serious. So binge eating disorder and OSFED are still really serious eating disorders.
Well, yeah, I even remember we talked about both of those with Bryn, and Bryn saying about how binge eating disorder is one of the most common eating disorders.
Right, but it doesn't get the same profile, right? And I think that's partly the world of anti-fatness, and I think that's the world of all the shame that comes with binge
I was going to say, I feel like, do we think it's to do with the shame around food and overeating? Or, I mean, I hate even saying the term overeating because I feel like that even has connotations.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's the shame and I think it's societal anti-fatness that mean we don't talk about binge eating disorder as much.
So what causes binge eating disorder?
Yikes. Big, big question. So like all eating disorders, the cause are complex and individual and varied. But research shows that factors like weight-based teasing, negative body image and dieting are all risk factors for binge eating disorder or binge eating that may lead to binge eating disorder, as well as food insecurity, which we discussed last time with our conversation with Josh. And then binge eating disorder is also often comorbid with substance use disorders and mood disorders like depression and anxiety. And I'm also sure that trauma plays a role for some people too, as a risk factor going into binge eating disorder.
So what do you think people should do if they're struggling with binge eating disorder?
Yeah, really good question. So in the UK, we've got BEAT, so the UK Eating Disorder Charity, and they've got some really helpful information on their website, and we can link to that in the show notes. Absolutely should speak to your GP. There are treatments out there to help people with binge eating disorder. Their therapeutic options like CBT can be really helpful for a lot of people. And then I think it's really worth remembering that practicing self-compassion can be a really valuable tool. So as distressing as a binge can be, beating yourself up about it is never going to help. I'd say if you have a binge eating episode, that's when you really need to double down on the self-care, be extra nice to yourself, and do your best to keep eating regular meals as much as you can. Because I think, as we were talking before about this binge restrict, like kind of yo-yo that we see, or pendulum swing, that restriction will set people up for a binge again. So that's something that we really want to avoid. Ideally, you'll be doing all of this with the support of a therapist and perhaps a dietitian and perhaps others involved. But we know there is a huge issue in the UK and elsewhere in the world in terms of access for eating disorder treatment, perhaps particularly for binge eating disorder. So just would really encourage you to, again, look at the BEAT website. There's a few pointers there. And then there are some things you can do to set yourself on that recovery path or get back on track, like the self-compassion piece.
And before we wrap up, can we cover a few do's and don'ts on the topic of binge eating disorder? For example, I don't say binge watch when I'm talking about TV, which has been difficult in a year of a lot of excessive watching. But it's a simple thing you can do. By changing your language, you can hopefully make people feel more comfortable.
Yeah, I think that's a really good one. It's such a common turn of phrase, but I also have tried to remove that from my vocab altogether, because just from hearing the distress it causes people when they hear it, in that sense, it's like a simple thing to do, right? To make people feel more comfortable. So another really important don't, and it's one of those things that shouldn't have to be said, but really does, is don't conflate binge eating disorder with body size. So it happens so much. It happens in a professional context. It's really harmful and not useful in any way. So binge eating disorder is a serious mental health condition where a key symptom of that condition is the behavior of binge eating. It's often associated with weight gain, but it occurs, importantly, across the weight spectrum. So there are plenty of people who live in higher weight bodies that do not have binge eating disorder, who do not binge eat, who do not have any loss of control over what they're eating. That's really, really important. And when we're thinking about body size, body size is body size is body size. There is a natural diversity of body sizes. So really important not to make any assumptions about anyone's eating habits based on their body size alone.
Completely. And also another thing we can do is, wherever you can, try to model body acceptance and food neutrality. So that's not using moral language around food, i.e. I'm so bad for eating this, or oh, we're so naughty for eating this, I've really earned this treat. None of that. We don't do that anymore. All food is good food. Eat what you want, when you want. Let's try and dissolve the shame away from bodies and eating.
Such a nice note to end on. Thank you for listening to The Body Protest.
We really hope you've enjoyed this episode, and it would mean the world to us if you could subscribe, rate and review.
You can follow Honey on Instagram at HoneyKinney.
And you can follow Nadia at Nadia.Craddock.
This podcast is produced and edited by the glorious Daisy Grant.
And it's brought to you by the Pink Protest Podcast Network.